My name is Mike Smith. The theme that I'm trying to follow up this week, or the topic that I'm interested in, is humanitarian intervention. And so what I wanted to do today and Wednesday is look first at the situation in Bosnia, or really the broader situation in Yugoslavia. On Wednesday, look at Somalia, and then Thursday and Friday, talk about both the United States and the United Nations and their possible roles in dealing with those kinds of situations. These are situations where I think we are appalled at what is happening in those situations and may feel that we have some responsibility to step in. There are also situations, I would think, where we don't identify clear United States interests. So it's not the sort of situation where we say that we are compelled to be involved, but we may feel that we have some kind of obligation. And so I want to spend the first 2 days looking at two of those sorts of situations, and spend Thursday and Friday then talking about the United States, what role it can play, or what the United Nations can do about it. If I didn't mention this, my name is Mike Smith, and I teach political science at a small college in southeastern Ohio. I have been doing this 1 week. I did this last week on another set of topics, and my experience was that some of the people in my sessions were fabulously informed about what I was talking about, and others came not knowing very much at all. So I'm going to assume that at least some of you don't know very much about this situation, and I will be talking about things, but I would welcome any comments or any support. Anyone who knows about the situation, I would welcome your contributions. Two, I feel some need to apologize. I like to arrange these things where there's a fair amount of time for discussion or conversation. I've not done that so much today because it seems like there's so much about the situation in Yugoslavia and in Bosnia that need to be put on the table first, but don't let that deter you. If you have something you want to contribute at any point, if you want to respond to something I've said or to add to it, please do so. What I am is a political science generalist who has tried to work up something on this situation. I feel like my training in comparative politics and foreign policy helped me know what to look for, but I am not a Yugoslav or Bosnian specialist. So if there's something you can contribute or a question you have at any point, please do that. I put up a map. I think this may have some more significance in just a moment. What I'd like to do to begin is I want to talk about Yugoslavia, the country of Yugoslavia, which is no longer. Talk about that a little bit. Then I have some recent history I want to project and talk our way through. After that, I want to ask the question, why did Yugoslavia break up? Because I think the breakup of Yugoslavia has relevance to Bosnia, that some of the same tensions that led Yugoslavia to break up are present in Bosnia and are part of a continuing problem in Bosnia. And then I really want to turn to you. If you have just come in, you may know better than I do what's been happening. I've been here for a week, and so I'm dependent on the New York Times when it arrives to know what's happening. So you may be better informed than I am of the most recent developments regarding Bosnia and Yugoslavia. I know part of the situation at this point is that there is a partition plan that's been proposed and there's discussion of, and this a little bit changes my lecture. When I came here, I did not anticipate that, and so it changes the direction a little bit, and so you can help me decide where to go at that point. But I want to begin with some comments about Yugoslavia. The name Yugoslavia stands for the land of the southern Slavs. So when Yugoslavia was put together, the notion was we've got these Slavic peoples and let's sort of lump them together. There was some assumption that it made sense to lump them together and create this land Yugoslavia. There are six major nationalities. By now you probably are acquainted with most of these. Six major nationalities in that land called Yugoslavia. They were the Bosnian Muslims. And I would assume you can probably find a few others if you look hard enough. But these are the major and the lesser nationality groups lumped together, that were lumped together in what was Yugoslavia. in a pattern that is similar to what happened in the Soviet Union. Yugoslavia was put together to consist of six republics, and each republic corresponded more or less to one of these major ethnic groups. And so you had Bosnia and Herzegovina. Which I find spelled differently every time I look at it. You have Croatia for the Croats. You have Macedonia or some such thing. The Greeks object to Macedonia being called Macedonia, and so this is a bit of a problem. You have Montenegro. And Slovenia. So each of the major nationality groups, in a sense, had a republic that was its republic. My impression is the Bosnian Muslims were, that was the most difficult situation. Bosnia and Herzegovina included an awful lot of other people who were not Bosnian Muslims. But the other thing to say about these various ethnic groups is that they were scattered around somewhat, so that it would be very nice if all of the Serbs were in Serbia and no one else was there, but that's not how it was. There were substantial chunks of Serbs in Croatia and also in, obviously, in Bosnia and Herzegovina, some Serbs in some other places, and the other peoples are also scattered around to some degree, so that it's not, the borders aren't neat, and you don't have all of one people in one republic and so forth. Yugoslavia was initially formed after World War I. It was formed by combining Serbia and Montenegro with remnants of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So the Austro-Hungarian Empire was dismantled, and parts that had been in that empire were added to Serbia and Montenegro, and Yugoslavia was created. There apparently was some ethnic tension in the 20s and 30s. The ruler of Yugoslavia, in some sense, was the Serbian king. So there was some degree of Serbian dominance and some resentment of that by the other nationalities. My impression is that the Serbs were able to come out of that and feel that in some way they were deprived of their rights, and at the same time everyone else could come out of that and feel that, like they were bullied by the Serbs. So there are different readings of the history of that period between World War I and World War II. After World War II, during World War II, some of the peoples in what had been Yugoslavia seemed to side with the Germans, and others opposed the Germans. There was a strong nationalist movement trying to drive out the Germans, and Tito emerged as a nationalist, a great Yugoslav patriot, and as a communist to be a leader of the Yugoslav people and to be the leader of the country then that is formed or reformed after World War II. And Tito is a major figure because he is able to hold Yugoslavia together. And as I've looked into this, I'm inclined to go back and study Tito and figure out what did he have? How was Tito able to hold this mixed population together? I'm not sure. But he is a very important figure, and I think once Tito dies, then things begin to unravel. So that becomes a significant event. There are three major religions represented in Yugoslavia: Eastern Orthodox, and I'm not going to write this down, but most of the people of Macedonia are Eastern Orthodox, the Montenegrins and the Serbs. So one of the things that binds the Serbs and the Montenegrins together is their religion. Roman Catholic, most of the Croats and the Slovenes, and this is this area in the north. The Croats and the Slovenes are primarily Roman Catholic. And then you have Muslims, and the Muslims are obviously in Bosnia, also in Macedonia, some Muslims, and Kosovo. And there are two, I might mention that there are two autonomous provinces within, or there were within Serbia. Kosovo is one of them, and then there's another one in the north, Vojvodina, some such thing. I have trouble pronouncing that. In any event, there are a lot of Muslims in Kosovo, and they are primarily Albanian. So you have a large Albanian Muslim population in Kosovo, which is governed by Serbia. It is part of Serbia, sort of a special territory within Serbia. In addition to this, there are three official languages, or there were three official languages of Yugoslavia. You know, we have one and debate whether, you know, what status Spanish ought to have in the United States. They have three: Macedonian, Serbo-Croatian, and Slovenian. It's interesting that the Serbs and the Croats share a language, but they express it with different alphabets. So the Serbs use the Cyrillic alphabet and the Croats use the Roman alphabet. Just to, you know, to mix things up. If there's anything to bring you together, we have to find some way that it shouldn't work. So those are the basic features of Yugoslavia, the country that was. And I think you can see that there are a lot of problems. If you think of ethnic tension and conflict, if you think of the religious differences, the language differences, all of these are things that when we look at a country and we ask, you know, are there features that unite the people or divide the people, all of these are things that are sort of warning signs as potential sources of division in a country. What I want to do next is look at recent history. See what's been happening. And if you can add anything to this, I would welcome that. I will start with this at the top and slide up a little bit, I guess. Tito died in 1980, which does seem to be a major event in the history of Yugoslavia. The system that had been arranged was that power would be shared among the nationalities. They had a presidency, which I've never understood, but they had a kind of rotated, shared power, rotating presidency that it took a supermajority to make decisions, and they had a Serb-dominated army. The economic situation, considerable economic inequality in the Slovenia, which is closest to Western Europe, closest to the European community, was fairly well off. Yugoslavia, although a communist country, experimented much more with some independence in the various republics, allowing greater, substantial economic autonomy in the republics, and some of the republics did fairly well at that. And Slovenia did pretty well. Kosovo was in pretty poor condition. So there were fairly dramatic differences between the well-being of Slovenia and the impoverishment of Kosovo. By the late 1980s, the country had accumulated a large foreign debt and many of the republics, and was suffering from high inflation. So as if everything else weren't bad enough, the economy was also in bad shape in the late 1980s.
The other thing I think you could mention is that in the early 80s, 1981 and 1982, a real sort of rebellion started in Kosovo, which is this province that's 90% Albanian Muslims, they're all Albanian Muslims almost. And there was a substantial amount of Serbian repression that a lot of Croatians and Bosnians and others noticed. That, I mean, they were very harsh, and a lot of, you know, riots and slaughters and things.
Okay.
That was noted by many of the other, the Serbian army, of course, was in there to stomp on them. So that was noted by a lot of the other republics.
So this this alarmed other people, but the Serbs also saw this as
a threat.
As a problem, and something that they had to deal with, and they had to be tough in dealing with. Okay, I jump ahead just to the most recent years, 1989-1990. Slovenia and Croatia at this point. Now, part of the reason for focusing on 1989 is the breakup of the Soviet Union. It's the developments that Gorbachev is allowing in Eastern Europe, the independence movements that are breaking out in Poland and spreading from Poland elsewhere. Yugoslavia had economic ties with in Eastern Europe and with the Soviet Union, but had been still more independent, had not been under the thumb of the Soviet Union. Even so, with the apparent withdrawal of the Soviet Union, then there are movements in Yugoslavia. We want greater independence. We want more democratization. Slovenia and Croatia, in particular, thought this would be a good idea. If Yugoslavia is going to continue, they want a Yugoslavia where the republics are even more self-governing. At the same time, Serbia is saying, no, what we need is stronger control from the center. So you have an opposition on a political issue about the structure of the government. What also happens is Slovenia and Croatia decide that they will tolerate other political parties to participate in elections. Serbia does not do that, and because non-communist parties were allowed to compete in elections in Slovenia and Croatia in 1990, non-communists are elected to those governments. So you have a tough communist government still in power in Serbia, or you have other parties that were not communist parties that come to power in Slovenia and Croatia. As if everything else weren't bad enough. 1991, Slovenia and Croatia announced that they plan to withdraw from Yugoslavia. And the Yugoslav People's Army attacks Slovenia, and the reason they give is they want to hold Yugoslavia together. And they say they're doing this in the name of Yugoslavia. Now, it seems to me that in this country, we have generally seen this as a situation where the Serbs are the bad guys, and I don't want completely to deny that, but this is a civil war sort of situation. This is a situation where a portion of your country is saying, we're leaving, we're breaking away. And of course, what we did in this country 100 and some years ago was the other part of the country said, no, you're not. And we will use force of arms to prevent you from doing that. So we, in our experience, have a historic analog of having part of the country saying, we're leaving, and the other part of the country says, no, you can't. And we will use force to prevent you from breaking away. What seemed to happen fairly quickly in 1991 was that the army, which is substantially Serbian, decided that there were few Serbs in Slovenia and there were a number of Serbs in Croatia, and decided that it was probably more important to have access to and defend the Serbs in Croatia than it was to hang on to Slovenia. They may, in a sense, have accepted, we can't hold this all together, so what we will do is look out for our fellow Serbs. And so there is a shift from first sending the army into Slovenia, which, if you recall on the map, is the northernmost republic. Instead of sending withdraw the troops from Slovenia and send them into Croatia to maintain access to the substantial number of Serbs that were in Croatia. The European community responds then late 1991 by imposing economic sanctions, and the U.S. also decides to impose economic sanctions on Yugoslavia. In 1992 then the war spreads to Bosnia. So what has happened? Bosnia in 91 had not decided what it was doing. Slovenia and Croatia had decided, and what they decided to do is try to leave, and Serbia says, no, you can't do that, or if you do, we want to make sure we have access to our fellow Serbs and that they're taken care of if you are going to pull out. Bosnia then says, well, you know, this looks good to us too. And so the war spreads to Bosnia. I'm not sure if my dating here gets a little, or my order gets a little problematic. In January, and this goes back to the problem of Slovenia and Croatia, in January the European community decides to recognize Slovenia and Croatia. Germany, which historically had had fairly friendly relations with both of those peoples, says we need to do this. And there's a debate within the European community and Germany sort of saying, well, we're going to do it anyway and you better hop on board. Convinces the European community to move fairly quickly in recognizing Slovenia and Croatia, which is to say that Germany and the European community is saying Yugoslavia is no more. These are different countries. And I guess I'm inclined a little, if I may be judgmental at this point, inclined a little bit to think this aggravated the problem. Maybe Yugoslavia might have been held together, but once you have the European community saying there is no Yugoslavia, there are separate countries there, then there are separate countries there. And that's the situation you're dealing with. April, the U.S. also recognizes Slovenia and Croatia, and by April, Bosnia has also declared that it wants to be independent. And so the U.S. also recognizes Bosnia as an independent country. This is where my dates are jumbled. In February, the voters of Bosnia approved a referendum for independence. They said they wanted to be independent. The UN, and I don't have dates for all of this, imposes economic sanctions on Serbia, puts peacekeepers in place, wants to organize relief efforts in Bosnia and Croatia where there is fighting and where people are suffering. The UN condemns ethnic cleansing, where we get in 1992, we get reports of ethnic cleansing going on where people are trying to either kill or drive out people of other ethnic groups from parts of territory that they want to control. Most of the accusations of ethnic cleansing are made against the Serbs, but they are not the only ones. I recall the Croatians in areas being accused. I don't know that the Muslims were at that point.
Bosnia is also the most ethnically mixed province. It didn't have a majority of anybody. The Muslims were only like 48%. So they had Croatians like 70 or 80% Croatian, and Serbia is 90% Serbian, and Slovenia is 90% Slovenian. But Bosnia was the problem. It was a much bigger mix of people. Surveys are correct.
And the UN also then approves a naval blockade of later in the year to enforce the sanctions. Part of the difficulty militarily is that the Serbians were best armed. They were best equipped to take what they want to take and hold what they want to hold. So the reports I saw as a month or two ago was that Serbia was holding about 70% of Bosnia and Herzegovina, even though the Serbians were... What numbers do you have? I have 30% maybe?
The Serbs were 30, the Croatians were 20, and the Muslims were like 45 or 50. There's a mix of them.
But the Serbs have seized the largest part of Bosnia and Herzegovina. The Croatians are probably second, the Croats are second, and the Muslims have the smallest that they're trying to hang on to, and they, of course, are... this is what we keep getting the reports about them being driven into cities, and the cities are bombarded, and are driven into villages that become cities as the population swells, and then they're bombarded by Serbian artillery.
Why were the Serbs the best armed and best equipped? Wouldn't theoretically armaments have been available to all of them? This is all Russian driven originally, right? I mean, these are Russian armaments.
It is.
Why did they happen to have all the?
The Serbs controlled the army. They were like 70 or 80% of the army.
Just because the army was made up mostly of.
And the officers in particular were Serbian. You get strange instances, and I recall reports, I think last fall, of a Serbian general directing Bosnian forces against the Serbian army, and the Serbian saying, if we can ever catch that guy, he's a traitor, and we'll get him. And he says, I'm a Bosnian, and I'm defending Bosnia. So you get peculiar things occurring in this conflict. Problems of loyalty. Where does your loyalty lie? Is it with your republic or is it with your ethnic people?
I guess I go back one more question and say, why was the army made up all of Serbs? If this was a Yugoslavian army, why was it made up more universally of people from the whole country?
Traditionally, the Serbs have been in the ones, especially the officer corps was almost totally Serbian. Even though I think Tito tried very hard to history that I know of, tried very hard to balance it out. He was very good at playing certain groups off against other groups. And the Croatians controlled more of what I've understood of some of the banking and the finances. And the Serbs controlled the military, and he tried to sort of play people off against one another. But the Serbs were evidently the ones who really had access to the most weapons and could get it quickly enough. Because, of course, they weren't blockaded until 1992.
Yeah, the blockade doesn't begin till 92. One of the things, I guess I don't get real surprised by these situations, because one of the things you see in a lot of other developing countries is there is some group that emerges, and they are the ones in the army. And of course, it's, you know, if you get into this kind of struggle, that's where you'd like to be. But it's not uncommon that somebody is in that position. In this case, that doesn't explain why the Serbs had that position. The Serbs did feel that Tito discriminated against them. They did feel that Tito did various kinds of things to prevent them from having what was rightfully theirs. So there was a certain residual resentment of Tito. What happened subsequently?
But they left out.
Tito was,
yeah.
Croat.
What?
Was Tito?
He was a Croat, I believe. Although he did balance, he did keep it together, and he did balance things fairly well. The other thing is once you get in this conflict situation, there's a question of, can you get arms from the outside? Can, even though there is, you know, no one's supposed to sell you arms, can you get arms in anyway? And if you look at the border, Serbia has a fair, long border with a number of countries, and Montenegro was part, I don't know what they're doing today, but for a long time they hung on to the name Yugoslavia. They said, we are still Yugoslavia. Serbia and Montenegro did. So they're on the coast, they've got a long border over here. Croatia has a border with Hungary and also has a long on the border on the coast. This is the extent of the border on the coast for Bosnia and Herzegovina. There's just a small section down here. Otherwise, it's Croatia here and it's Serbia here that's cutting them off. So they have all, it's very difficult to smuggle arms into Bosnia, which aggravated problems for the Muslims. You start out at a disadvantage, and then just the geography of the situation works against the Muslims. So that's been a problem. And a naval blockade, there are a lot of ways to get arms into Serbia that don't involve bringing them in by sea. Anyway, back to these events. What happens then in 1993 is the Vance Owen plan gets talked about a lot in the early part of this year. The Vance Owen plan was a plan to break Bosnia into 10 separate areas. Bosnia would stay together. My understanding was Vance Owen had a kind of constitution. You were supposed to buy into the constitution and the plan. And part of the point was Bosnia does not get divided up. It remains united. That there would be these 10 regions. Each of the ethnic groups would tend to dominate some of those regions. The hope was, I think, that you would recognize that even in the regions you dominated, there were some people who were from other ethnic groups, but by the same token, there were some of your people in regions dominated by the other ethnic groups, and so there's an incentive. We don't mistreat these aliens in our regions, because they will miss, as they held, that on the ground they had more territory than the plan would give them. On the other hand, the problem on the other side, and this is something, Bill Clinton talked about in the campaign in 92, is we seem to be rewarding aggression. We were giving the Serbians more than they, if you look at their percentage of the population, they were getting more than they were entitled to. They were getting other people's territory. So in terms of justice, it didn't seem exactly just. In terms of practical politics, it seemed like it might be hard to sell to all of the parties. And I guess I think for some time what happened was that the Muslims had hopes that the United States or some other outside forces would come in on their side. So on the one hand, you have the Serbians who sort of say, we don't care what the world thinks. We're going to do what we want. The Serbians seem to have been especially bad at paying attention to public opinion. And at the same time, the Muslims, I think, were hoping for a sympathy vote there. And we're getting beat up on and we're not aggressing, so bail us out, world, come in and save us. And sometime this spring, the Serbs realized that wasn't going to happen. It became clear that the U.S. wasn't going to do that. It became clear that the European community wasn't going to go along with much of anything to save them. And so everyone was left to their own devices. In my sense, as you saw more fighting break out at that point, when that all became clear. What else? The U.S., we did do some things. We did try to step up our activity. So before this sort of giving up, we did these airdrops where we were dropping, you know, there were people we couldn't get to because the Serbs wouldn't let the convoys through, and so we dropped supplies into them. Okay, that's still going on. This is something that has tended to, it was something that I think the first week or two got coverage, and then we stopped talking about it.
There are still airdrops.
Well, I had the experience of people telling me it has stopped. They told me it was over, and I would periodically find something in the Times or someplace saying, no, you know, it is still going on, but it lost its visibility pretty quickly. The UN authorized enforcement of the no-fly zone. And then the UN, if you see part of the problem as the willingness of the world to recognize each of these republics as states, to say, okay, you are an independent self-governing country, then the UN also joined in that to some extent by admitting these as new countries. They've eagerly admitted, I don't want to push this too far, because once it splits up and falls apart, it's hard to put it back together again. But just as the UN fairly readily admitted the former republics of the Soviet Union, it has also fairly readily admitted the former republics of Yugoslavia, which is part of the reason we have a problem about Bosnia and Herzegovina. Once you say it is a country, then this is international aggression. If we had never admitted it was a country, we could pretend it was a civil war and maybe ignore it a little more readily. But once these are real countries, then this appears to be aggression or outside participation in a civil war, if you want to look at it that way, and may require more action by the international community. In any event, Macedonia was a problem, as I mentioned earlier, for a long time, because Greece objects to Macedonia being called Macedonia. And so it was admitted to the UN, and I believe the name under which it was admitted to the UN is the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. So it is not Macedonia, it is the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia. And Greece would accept that. That's okay. There is a substantial Macedonian population in northern Greece, and I'm not sure entirely what the Greeks are concerned about a young Alexander coming back and rallying the Macedonians. And well, I think they're afraid of losing territory. They're afraid of the Macedonians seeking independence and wanting to rejoin Macedonia to the north. And the U.S., I believe, has gotten committed to this to the point of sending 300 soldiers into Macedonia.
Did we send them to Macedonia
out of concern about the Serbs. But of course, it might be out of concern about the Greeks as well. I'm not entirely sure. Of course, the Greeks are our allies in NATO. But that didn't stop the Greeks and the Turks from squabbling over Cyprus some years ago. Those are the things I've got, unless you want to add anything in terms of recent history.
Well, I know from a European standpoint, there's still been a lot of... Recently, Secretary of State Christopher last week made sort of a big flack by saying that the reason that there were so many problems in Bosnia was that the Germans had recognized, your point, you agree, Secretary Christopher, that the Germans had recognized too quickly. And the Europeans can't seem to decide. There was a European summit meeting last week, and they still can't seem to decide what it is that they, some of their points are, well, the United States should leave. Well, as you know, Clinton tried that a month ago or two ago. He sent the Secretary of State around saying, we want to start bombing Serbian positions. You know, this could be a tactic for, trying to increase acceptance of this plan. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, we don't want to do that. So, but now they say Macedonia should leave, but, don't leave too much. So it's but they don't want to leave. The Germans, of course, don't want to send any troops anywhere. So, and they say they can't through their history. They invaded Croatia.
And they have some sort of constitutional problem.
Yeah, it's in their constitution, they're not supposed to, but that could be
dealt with.
Yeah. The only other thing that's happened is, as you said earlier, is that there's three things now there, but again, Bosnia Croatia and the Serbs accepted it and Bosnia didn't accept it. The last I heard was 2 days ago.
This is the new plan.
That's the new plan.
And
which is not surprising because Bosnia wasn't getting anything out of it, so why should they accept it?
And there was some sort of split, I believe, in the Bosnian leadership. That's what I'm picking up from the Times. So that some of the Bosnian leaders are willing to accept it, but there are no Muslims, I think, among the Bosnian leaders who are willing to accept it. And that's the problem, is if you can't get the Muslims to sign on, the conflict in all likelihood will continue. Well, I'd like to change our focus then just for a moment and go back to the question, why did Yugoslavia break up? Now, I think we've given plenty of reasons here, but let's think about that for a moment. And I wanted to write some of this on the board here. But what do you see as, and part of what I want to get at by this is I think that this situation can be interpreted in different ways. And depending on how you interpret the explanation you give as to why Yugoslavia broke up, I think that influences your attitude or your response to questions about the need to do something about the situation in Bosnia. But I want to try to draw that out a little bit. So
sounds like an artificial union to begin with.
Okay. So you would say it was natural for it to break up because of ethnic diversity?
Mm-hmm. It probably helped in Steve to begin with and only held together because of Tito, and after that, unless you get another Tito, chances are it's going to hang together.
Okay. Ethnic diversity, and with that, the religious diversity that we're aware of. I haven't heard it for some time, but I recall hearing some reports of leaders rousing their people by making references to some sort of religious discrimination in the past, that those Muslims have done terrible things to us in the past and we're just paying them back, that sort of thing.
You keep hearing that that what they're saying is that this has been suppressed for all these years and that these disagreements that were there and these hatreds, I guess, and absolute abhorrence of the other sides have been there all the time, and it's been perpetuated through, I guess, a couple of generations now. And still, as soon as it was possible to vent these frustrations, then they came to the fore.
When you read about the Serbs, for example, the Serbs' big thing that they hark back to is a battle they lost in 1489, that they lost to the Turks. On this, which is in Kosovo, which is in this place that is now dominated by Muslims. And it is their sacred, it's called the Field of Blood. And they're this is their homeland, this is the homeland of Serbia. Unfortunately, it's now occupied by 90% by these other people who don't particularly want the Serbs there and who have been intifada or whatever. I mean, they've been fighting them off and on for a long time. I mean, that's what the Serbs hark back. I just read a book on the Balkans and everything, and one man was saying, where were you? He's asking this reporter says, isn't it terrible that you're oppressing all these people? He says, where were you at the Battle of 14? Where was the Western press then? I don't know.
And it has some name like the Poultry Creek or something. For us it's insignificant, but it's...
For them it's the heartland of Serbia, and it's unfortunately occupied now by, not occupied, but has 90%.
Sounds like an Israel-Palestine problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's one of the comparisons they make. Is that you have people fighting over sacred land,
sacred land. At what point was it sacred to whom?
Well, let me put this up, because people who study ethnicity and ethnic groups say that when your homeland is at issue, that the fights are just much more bitter. And particularly if it's two people's homelands, that's his issue, which is part of the Israel-Palestine problem. But at least that's the problem here with the Serbs, is they see their homeland is at stake, and it is Albanian Muslims. It's not Turkish Muslims.
They're Muslims.
They're Muslims, and that's unacceptable. So, homelands.
And it could be here in the United States to a lesser degree with the quote, Native Americans, vis-a-vis those of us who were.
If they had the power to do something about it. But they don't. Okay, what other kinds of explanations would you be inclined to give?
The end of the Cold War contributed to this idea that people could now decide for themselves. They didn't have an oppressive government.
Okay, you have the end of the Cold War, and yeah, one arm of that is the whole democratization that seems to be going on.
The economic collapse.
Yeah.
Like that.
Okay.
Yes, it's stress.
The economic collapse. Well, you're including that as end of the Cold
That's
War.
Stimulated that whole, which really had the tie to the Soviet Union.
And to other countries in Eastern Europe, yeah. So it was a breakdown, and partly this was internal, that they had a system that for some time worked fairly effectively. We tended to look at Yugoslavia as one of the better off Eastern European communist countries. They had workers' control. We used to be fascinated by democratization in the factories and so forth. I'm sure dozens of American political scientists went over and studied democracy in the workplace in Yugoslavia, having known a couple of them. So that was something. I'm inclined to say also in terms of the end of the Cold War that there may have been some kind of military threat, and I have trouble exactly pinning this down, but as long as the Soviet Union is present or omnipresent there, these various nationalities may have some reason to hang together. Now, that reasoning even though that's my reasoning, it doesn't make perfect sense because the Serbs have historic connections with Russia and they might have less reason to see a need to hang together. But perhaps the Slovenes and the Croats, et cetera, said, well, we won't break away. You know, we'll stay a part of this unit as long as there's, you know, Russia over there that might be some kind of problem. As long as the Warsaw Pact is a serious threat. But that's gone. So that kind of military withdrawal that occurs in 1989. You know, if the Russians are prepared to leave Germany and leave Poland, certainly they're not going to be concerned about Yugoslavia. Can you see any other kinds of explanations?
Well, what about the languages? Does that matter? The different languages?
I would think it aggravates the other problems. Mm-hmm. So add that. I would add that to the ethnic and religious diversity as the linguistic diversity.
Do they have to learn two languages in school, or?
I don't know what they're in
for. Under Tito, for example, the American consulates there in Yugoslavia and Nosy only had to print things in Serbo-Croatian in English, right? Which was the basic. Now, of course, everybody wanted it only printed in Croatian in their Latin alphabet, and the Serbians only wanted it in Serbo-Croatian in their Cyrillic alphabet. But under Tito, they had, you know, pretty much Serbo-Croatian. They had three languages, but Serbo-Croatian was
the dominant.
They used. Then, you know, other places they speak Muslims, but I don't know what the Albanian Muslims speak.
Albanian? It would make sense.
Yeah.
At home, I imagine they would speak Albanian. Other explanations, or do we have enough?
Lack of a history of unity.
Okay.
But there isn't a sense of the whole, and I think also the way the United Nations has been, and the European community, and the fragmentation of that, you know, it certainly is recently exacerbated.
Yeah, I suppose you can.
Because the wars got there, the First World War spun off of that.
Is there a responsibility out there? You know, the UN's had difficulty, of course, determining. Does it have a responsibility in this whole thing at all?
Right.
And of course, then further down from that, does the United States have a responsibility in
does the
doing
UN
it? Or is this an internal thing that we keep our hands off? You know.
Yeah.
Right.
Could we have held it together if we wanted to? Probably not, but.
But I think we could.
Save people's lives?
We could have left it alone. So the international community was, yeah.
Maybe they precipitated some things which they shouldn't have precipitated.
So the international community lacked any kind of unified perspective. They didn't agree on what they were doing. Or unified approach. And I have to say, this is maybe not directly pertinent, but the European community has been trying to achieve greater unity. And part of the point of the Maastricht Treaty was greater unity, and an important element of that was we want a common foreign policy. And this is a great test, I think, for the Europeans of their ability to forge a common foreign policy, how easy that will or will not be. It's a lot easier to form, a common foreign policy toward, say, South Africa than it is toward Yugoslavia that's so close to home and where there are so many historic connections. Well, I think they have been fighting on and off for hundreds of years. The fact that the Serbs recall these events, you know, 600 years ago and hark back to that and say, we're just trying to recover what was from this wrong that was done to us so many hundreds of years ago.
And of course, if they had been able to, well, maybe they never were, I don't know that much history, but if they had managed to stay within their own boundaries, if the Serbs had been within a boundary and the Muslims within a boundary, and you know, then they might could have broken up now and been content with what they had. But my understanding is that there's just a tremendous amount of I mean, sure, it's, one of them is, say, 80% or 90% or whatever, but there's a contingent in there that, you know, this is not. We're not you. We're not the same as you guys.
Well, everyone wants to go back to the greatest expanse of their whenever their empire was at its greatest. You know, the Serbs say they should go back to just before the Ottoman Turks overran them in 1489, which, you know, was most of then all the Balkans. And the both, you know, if you start getting the other people, the Macedonians can go back to what, 2000 BC and say that they had most of that area.
Yeah, they get all the way over to India.
Yeah, and they take over. Saying the Bulgarians also used to be all the way to the Adriatic. They say that they should go back in the 700s and 800s. I mean, who's...
Yeah, the various empires have waxed and waned, and as one expands, another, you know, if you're the weaker force, you retreat, and you may in fact drive someone out of the way when you retreat. So you then have some claim to some chunk of territory. You were driven there, but it's still, that was where you were for a while. And so it makes it very problematic to agree. Where do you draw the lines among these peoples? Well, the latest development, and you may be able to say more about this than I, the latest development is there is a new plan for partition. Has anyone seen the plan? I saw something in the Times that they said was a reproduction from something published in a newspaper someplace, but was not authoritative.
Heard it on CNN a couple days ago. I mean, that's what I was reading.
So
it's divided into three instead of 10 autonomous regions, and the Serbs would still get to jump the line and share.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
What they got on the ground, they would keep, basically.
Yeah. It was the map I saw was something. Yeah. They got a chunk here, and they got a chunk here.
The Croatians got
something here, and mm-hmm. the Muslims got a little piece here, and I think...
Sarajevo. Then they got Sarajevo
and Tuzla, I believe.
And that little territory right there around Tuzla.
Okay.
But basically...
They didn't come out with very much out of that.
That's why they're not agreeing to plan.
So military worked for the Serbs.
It appears at this point, but the Muslims haven't accepted it yet. Now I believe the notion is that this plan or something like this would be the starting point for negotiations. So they would begin from negotiating, but. You know, once you've got a map, this would be the concern of the Muslims. Once there's some sort of map, then it's going to be hard to negotiate away from that map, and especially given the fact that Serbs control so much territory. Now, what are the cards the Muslims have to play?
There. The sympathy vote didn't work, so.
Yeah.
fighters coming over to help them, and some from Iran.
Yeah, there have been...
In Europe, but there are rumors that they've got, but not anything like the way the Serbs are getting it from Romania.
Rumors of planes carrying something. And there was a UN contingent that was caught by the Serbs when the Serbs were searching. One of the relief convoys, they searched the trucks and found arms hidden among the medical supplies or something or other, which made the UN look very bad for a moment there. And if the Serbs want to sort of aggravate their sense that they're being picked on, they say even the UN is cheating and aiding our enemies.
That lesson would have happened back a while ago if we had armed the Muslims so that they could adequately defend themselves, then we might have had even a bigger war.
Well, and this is another issue. The president has said he thinks we ought to end the embargo as far as the Muslims are concerned and allow the Muslims to acquire arms, but the European community will not go along with that. They're not prepared to support that idea. That may not be as bad as it sounds. They may be saying, we think we can contain the bloodshed, even though, yeah, the Muslims are going to suffer. There will be less violence and less bloodshed if someone isn't armed than if everyone is armed. So they may be being sensible and practical, and they may be just bloody-minded Europeans. Any other information about this partition plan or any other thoughts about it that you have?
The chances of this even working any better than what we've been doing for years with the Israelis and the Palestinians?
Well, that's where I come down. I mean, that, in a sense, that was my next question, was let's say they do get an agreement. What are the chances that the various parties are going to abide by that agreement? Yes.
Yes, my concern about this was during World War II, three panzer divisions in the SS failed to subdue these people. And it's hard for me to imagine the US, the UN, or any other force going in with the ruthlessness that those three panzer divisions in the SS had at their disposal.
Mm-hmm.
They were there 5.5 years. And at the end, the Yugoslav partisans were still coming out of Kiev shooting Germans, blowing bridges, etc. And it's just harder for me to imagine any military solution from the outside, given the failure with essentially similar weapons. I mean, nobody's suggesting that we thermonuclearly destruct the place. And so using conventional weapons, which are not significantly different from what the Nazis had, it's hard to imagine with anybody giving any men of arms to anybody,
mm-hmm.
other than Washington.
Yeah.
I think that's the U.S. military's concern, is that instead of fighting in the jungles, you fight in the hills. And you'd still have everybody shooting who was a friendly and who wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they'd rather fight in the desert.
Yes.
Yeah. Fighting in the
flat,
desert
flat
is...
Flat land is almost...
So.
Open skies.
Yeah.
The bears going over there.
Okay. I asked a moment ago the question, do you think the various parties would abide by, if they reach an agreement, would they abide by such an agreement? I'm not sure you answered that, although maybe the fact that you didn't tells the whole story. If there were such an agreement, we might well be asked to provide troops to help enforce the agreement. Is that anything we ought to do? The United States, should the United States provide forces, you know, if there were an agreement, should we provide forces to help enforce such an agreement?
If there is an agreement of any kind, it has to be an agreement that sticks and holds on its own. I don't think it can conceivably be, or should ever be, enforced by groups from the outside. If somebody agrees to do something, then they either agree to stick with it and they do it. It can't be imposed. They agree to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
but I think if you had them, you'd have to have somebody there who could sort of be the buffer, the way people in the Sinai, when Egypt and Israel negotiated this peace treaty, for a long time there were, I think there still are, peacekeeping troops in the Sinai, aren't there?
Yeah, there are.
A few, you know, monitoring to make sure that there were no corrections.
Basically, Israel gave it back and...
Right, and, well, everybody had agreed. Plus, it's much easier to can at the desert.
And there's a pretty...
Yeah, partitions are, but that, I'm not sure.
In the political side, is this a civil war, isn't it?
Well, these things, governments decide how, what to call it.
In your opinion, does it fit the criteria that political scientists would look at and say, is this a civil war?
I prefer to hide behind that sort of legalistic answer I just gave you, that the governments determine what it is, and if most governments regard it as one thing or the other, this situation is particularly difficult. Once Bosnia is treated as an independent country, and you have Serbian forces then operating, and at least many of the Serbian, as I understand it, many of the Serbian forces operating in Bosnia are Bosnian Serbs who are doing that. And so the question is, how much support are they getting across the border from Serbia? To what extent are they directed from Serbia? And to what extent are they not directed from Serbia? Milosevic in Serbia for a long time has said, I don't have control over those people. You know, they're doing these things and I just can't control it. Now, he may be controlling it, and politically it's in his interest to say he can't. You know, but that's the critical question, is to what extent are the Serbs in Bosnia independent actors, and to what extent are they controlled from outside? If it's primarily outside, then it's international war. Since we said Bosnia is an independent country.
But is there even a central now? I mean, I think in some way you'll probably talk about Somalia. Do you have a functioning central government in Bosnia? I mean, there's some sort of Bosnian-Serbian legislature that met and rejected several things as well. I mean, who's in charge? Those poor people in Sarajevo, you know, being bombarded for a year. That is what the seat of government is.
Sarajevo. There are two civil wars can go on either two ways. You can have a civil war because you have parts of the country that want to break away and be independent, and then you fight because the other parts say, we don't want you to break away. You can have a civil war because some people in the country want to overthrow the government in power. To the extent this is a civil war, it's one where parts of the country want to break away.